People for sticking around to this part of the afternoon, and also thank Michelle for the invitation to come and talk. And this will actually be the first of two talks on Spin Ice, so everybody will be up to full speed on the topic by the time we're done, I hope. The work I've done, as in any experimental group, the work is not all done by myself. There's a lot of collaborators who I think I've mostly listed up there. I hope I haven't missed too many people. The top row of people were mostly involved with the MuSR experiments that were done at Triumph. The middle group of people were done in involved heavily in growing and characterizing the samples, which we grew in the image furnace at McMaster. And the last group of Michelle Gingras has been very important in understanding, sort of theoretical understanding of the work that we've been doing. So geometric frustration is a very important subject in a lot of our lives around here. You can imagine it, see it quite clearly. If you have three spins which are antiferromagnetically coupled, if two of them decide to satisfy themselves by being up and down, then the third one is frustrated, and so the system has trouble finding a ground state. And you can do this in a two-dimensional structure, so you get triangular lattices and Kagame lattices and the like. If you do it in a three-dimensional structure, the building block are tetrahedra. Here again, you've got two up, an up and a down, and the other two are both frustrated. The basic idea is when you have this large amount of magnetic energy which can't relieve itself by classical ordering, then the possibility of new ground states emerging comes along, and you can also get competing phases, and perhaps maybe one day they'll dope charge carriers into these things and they'll become superconductors. Have to include another picture, of course. This is from our recent newspaper article in Hamilton showing a frustrated lattice in the hands of, I think he was called a scatterbrain scientist, announcing his Brockhaus Prize, for much of which I think a lot of the work has been done on pyrochlore systems, which we're showing here, which are made up of corner-sharing tetrahedron, which is the lattice geometry we're talking about today. One of the things that we're all, the idea of a spin liquid is also sort of quite pervasive in this topic. If we have a magnetic system that doesn't develop long-range order, the idea introduced by Anderson is you could perhaps have this RVB state where you have if this is some triangular lattice where each of these is a singlet, sort of a combination of up, down, and down, up, and then you have all different combinations of these things with this is a so-called RVB state. And that's something that sort of state has been postulated, and it's really a holy grail in some sense to try and discover examples of such a thing. So there's only been a few materials. There's a very nice review article by Balance discussing this. There's only a few candidate materials which have really been identified. So looking for other examples of spin liquids where you have strong magnetic interactions and yet no order happens down to low temperatures is still something we're working on. So spin ice is a name given to a group of materials of which two of the examples are holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate. And in these materials, you have this pyrochlore lattice where there's two interpenetrating sets of tetrahedron here, and the holmium or the dysprosium sit on the vertices as one of these. So you have this interpenetrating lattice as shown here. So the only magnetic moments in this particular problem are on the holmium or the dysprosium. The titaniums are non-magnetic. There's a very strong crystal field anisotropy in these materials, and so the spins in these particular compounds are constrained to either point towards the center of one of the tetrahedron or away from the center. And that energy scale is quite high, so at the low temperatures that we're concerned with in this experiment, we can take that as an absolute constraint. In these particular materials, the interaction between the dysprosium atoms or ions or the holmium atoms is ferromagnetic, and so the constraint, if you try and bring these spins pointing in or out and you want to ferromagnetically couple them, the ground state for arranging the spins in one tetrahedron is to have two spins in and two spins out. And this is known as the ice rules. But for each tetrahedron, there's actually six different ways you can do that. So each tetrahedron has a six-fold degenerate ground state, and then these things are only loosely talking to each other. So in fact, there's a macroscopic degeneracy of the ground state because each of these tetrahedron can act essentially independently. The term ice comes along from looking at the arrangement of hydrogen and oxygen in water ice, a given oxygen atom will be closely bound to two hydrogen atoms in its H2O molecule, and then will be hydrogen bonded more weakly to two others. So for if you look at an individual oxygen atom, it will have two close hydrogens and two far hydrogens. And again, those could be arranged in different many different ways. So the statistical mechanics of this system is exactly the same for this. So in an original paper by Ramirez and collaborators, they looked at the they measured the specific heat of this was dysprosium or holmium titanate, and they found a large residual entropy associated with the large degeneracy of the ground state. Okay, so we'll have to walk over there to the next slide. Okay, so these ions, the holmium, the dysprosium, have very large magnetic moments, something like 10 Bohr magnetons. And so there's a very large dipole interaction between these different ions. And that's the dipole interaction strength is on the order of 1 to 2 Kelvin. So that's quite substantial. There's also an exchange interaction, J nearest neighbor, which is also important and is also comparable. There's some very nice work done by Michel Gingras and his postdoc at the time, Byron de Nertog, where they worked out the specific heat and the entropy in detail of the system and mapped out phase diagrams in terms of the exchange coupling and the dipole coupling to find the spin ice state. One of the things that they stress, of course, is that as you cool down from high temperatures, okay, the specific heat increases, but there's no actual phase transition. It's a crossover to the spin ice state. So there's no thermodynamic phase transition in the system. They also put one of the things that comes out in both the simulations and in the experiments is that there can be very long and slow dynamics, and essentially because you have these large icing spins, and they have to, in order to get to a ground state configuration, they have to do spin flips, and those can be energetically expensive. And also because they're icing spins, these sort of tunneling events seem to be less possible. Neutron diffraction studies have shown that there is no long-range magnetic order in these materials. There's only short-range ferromagnetic correlations. These are sort of experiment, and that's a simulation. But again, the only sharp peaks that are seen in this particular ones are due to nuclear scattering. So there's no long-range magnetic order in the spin ice state at low temperature. There is, however, some low-temperature irreversibility in the system. So these are measurements of the magnetic susceptibility measured in a variety of fields. So this is for the dysprosium version. And you can see below about 600 millikelvin in these materials, the field cooled and zero field susceptibility becomes quite irreversible. Okay. So there was a great deal of interest in this material, of course, when it was first discovered and characterizing the spin ice state, and this all happened about sort of on the order of 10 years ago. More recently, the interest has come about from the idea that perhaps one could observe magnetic monopoles in spin ice. And since we all know from our E&M courses that magnetic monopoles don't exist sort of in isolation, here's an example where perhaps an emergent quasi-particle, if you like, could come out much the way that the fractional quantum Hall states could observe, where we could study these things via the quasi-particles. So the basic idea is if you have a system here which is obeying the ice rules, where you have two in and two out, if you take an excitation which flips one spin, You can essentially now have a defect here. Here we flip the spin here, and we can view that excitation as essentially being a dipole of two monopoles, which can then move apart as we move the spin flip throughout the system. And so this idea was put forward that these things could be thermally excited spin flips could give these sort of effective monopoles, which can then separate themselves. Of course, as they move apart, they leave a sort of a wake of damage in their trail, and so this gives an interaction which when they worked out the details, essentially looked like a Coulomb type of potential, and so hence we could think of we could write down the total energy of this system as looking essentially like a Coulomb interaction between these monopoles, which are then separated off through space. So there was some detailed magnetic neutron scattering work done. This is comparing spin flip and non-spin flip scattering and looking at the so-called pinch points here, and essentially comparing to a Monte Carlo simulation of what would be expected, to see in such a situation. What you're basically, what they were looking for basically is looking for the sort of the field distribution that comes from these separated flip charges in this monopole idea. And the idea was that in fact, that this comparison between the two was sufficiently strong that gave some evidence for the existence of these monopoles. If one takes these monopoles, though, and if you take the idea seriously, if you take two charged particles and you put them in an electric field, you will separate the charged particles. So if you take this idea seriously in the magnetic monopole case, if you apply a DC magnetic field, you should sort of separate apart the monopoles in the same way. So this is a figure taken from the paper of the group of Steve Bramwell. And so here are these sort of spontaneously generated monopoles. You apply a magnetic field and you drift them apart. And then the idea of the experiment, which I'm going to discuss, is that if you then implant positive muons into the system, the muon will sit there and sit there somewhere in the sample and will sense the dipole field created by these two separated monopoles. And in fact, if these spins are fluctuating, then we'll see the fluctuation rate as well. So that was the sort of the motivation for the experiment. So in order to do a MuSR experiment, which is what we did, you need to have positively polarized muons. We get them at an accelerator like Triumph by creating pions at the rest of on the surface of a production target. Pions, if you take a pion is a pi zero, has no spin. If it's at rest, when it decays into a muon and a neutrino, the neutrino will go one way, and to conserve linear momentum, the muon will go the other way. The neutrinos are all left-handed, thanks to T.D. Lee. And so the muons are created with 100% spin polarization. So we have, by going to an accelerator, if we take a beam of muons, they will be created for us with complete spin polarization. The pion itself, that just goes through that argument. This is due to parity violation. I think I've missed a slide there. It's okay. So the experiments were done at Triumph, which is in Vancouver. The Pacific Ocean is down here somewhere. So here's a view of the laboratory. You have a cyclotron in the middle, which is a 500 MeV proton machine. Protons are extracted down this beam line. There's two production targets here and here. And then the muons are created that go off into the secondary channels, which are located around these different areas out here. If you're interested in high-energy astrophysics, the beams are taken up to this area for doing experiments and things like looking at supernova-type processes and things like that. So here's a sort of a view of the hall. The cyclotron is underneath this large bunch of concrete blocks. The proton beam comes down under this level of blocks. And the muon beam lines come out the secondary channels along here. There's a sort of a standard-sized liquid nitrogen dewar just to get some scale to this situation. Here's two graduate students standing beside a dilution refrigerator, which is used for these experiments, back here. So we have the muon beam coming in from the right and then stopping in the sample there. So here's how an experiment works. A muon comes in one at a time. A single muon goes in, passes through a detector, and starts a clock. The muon then lands in the sample, where the spin processes in the whatever magnetic field happens to be there, and then till the muon itself decays 2 microseconds later. Let me go back and run that again just as I keep talking. So we start the clock with the muon arriving. We stop the clock when a positron is detected, and we make a histogram of detected positrons for each positron detector we have. And we increment a time bin at the time interval corresponding to the difference between the muon arriving and decaying. The muon itself is unstable. It has a 2.2 microsecond lifetime. And because it's a three-body final state, there's not complete polarization in the emission probability. But the positron is still given off preferentially in the direction of the muon spin at the time of decay. So if the spins were doing nothing in the sample, we would just measure the muon lifetime curve, which of course we know that. By taking but superimposed upon that, if the spins are precessing, if the muon happens to decay when the spin is pointing towards the detector, we'll see an enhancement in the count rate. And if it happens to be pointing away from the detector when it happens to decay, we'll see a decrease in the count rate. So superimposed on the muon lifetime is the spin polarization function of the muon spin ensemble. We, of course, do this for perhaps 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 8th muons. And we would also typically have opposing counters and from which case we can then extract the polarization function. So here are the two experimental geometries we can typically use. We use a transverse field geometry where we have the muon spins prepared perpendicular to any magnetic field we might have. which case the spins will just precess as I showed you, and here's an actual non-schematic, an actual picture of what a precession signal looks like. Or we can do an experiment in zero or longitudinal field where any magnetic field which is applied is along the direction of the spin polarization. In both cases, we have pairs of detectors. And so if the muon starts pointing towards one detector, then they're pointing away from the other detector. So by forming what we call an asymmetry, where we take the difference divided by the sum and the count rates, the muon lifetime disappears from the equation. The only effect of the muon lifetime on any of the spectra I'll ever show you is that our error bars grow in time. So that everything I'm showing you now is just going to be a spin polarization function, which is directly extracted from the data. And I should point out that our data lives in the time domain, so our error bars are well-defined. They're just counting statistics. So we have a fairly good handle on our error bars everywhere throughout. So here's some spectra just taken this is just representative data taken. This is an antiferromagnetic system. So there's no applied magnetic field here. This is an oxide of calcium and vanadium. And you see here there's two precession frequencies. And that's because of this material. There are two different muon sites at slightly different places in the crystal structure, and so they see slightly different local fields, even though there's only one ordered vanadium moment. If we plot the temperature dependence of the frequency, this is just an order parameter. It looks like the square root of a Bragg peak intensity in magnetic neutron scattering. But muons are a real space probe as opposed to neutrons, and so they actually are quite useful for looking at systems where we don't have long-range order, but where we have, for example, spin glossy order or something like that, in which case you don't see a unique local field at the muon site anymore. You see a distribution of fields, but this gives a characteristic relaxation function which we can still fit and extract, for example, an Edwards-Anderson order parameter, if you like, for a spin gloss. If we so the sort of experiments that I'm going to talk about today are using a couple of different capabilities that we have. First, I'm going to talk about some experiments that were done on a very low background apparatus. Where essentially we mount this, our single crystals are mounted on a very thin metal or plastic foil and then surrounded by space so that any muons which miss our sample land somewhere else and they're out of the experiment. So we can keep them out of the experiment completely. The other experiments I'm going to talk about were done in a dilution refrigerator. So here's the sample holder which top loads down into the dilution fridge. In a dilution fridge, your thermal contact to your sample is by contact, direct mechanical contact. So you have to have a sample holder with some thermal conductivity. So there's necessarily a background signal in your spectrum coming from the sample holder, which in this case is a piece of high purity silver. But you have to know that background is there and be able to understand it and subtract it. Just for completeness, we can also do measurements in fields now up to 7.5 tesla, which corresponds to a precession frequency of a gigahertz, which means that all of our timing electronics has to be good to about 100 picoseconds, which it is now. We've also developed a high pressure capability, so we can now get for looking at materials like uranium, ruthenium, two silicon, two. We can get to pressures of about 22,000 atmospheres and temperatures down to about 2.5 Kelvin, and actually stop more than half of the muons in a sample, which is doing pretty well. Okay, so I'm going to there's after this discussion of monopoles and spin ice, there appeared a very high profile paper in Nature. By a group of Steve Bramwell, where they claim to have used muon spin rotation to prove the existence of monopoles. Okay? So this got a lot of attention. So the gist of what I'm going to tell you is that this experiment is completely wrong, and it's wrong in a multitude of ways, and I'm going to take you through a couple of them, the most important ones. So in order to know why it's wrong, then we have to understand the experiment, because clearly the referees did not. Okay? So this was a transverse field relaxation rate experiment. So they applied a magnetic field, and they looked at the precession of the muon signal. And they're measuring characteristics of this precession signal. So here is their data. Okay? So here's data taken in 10 Gauss and 20 Gauss. Okay? So they're looking at, this is a precession signal. I can't remember what temperature this was looking at. But they're measuring what they're fitting, and what they care about this is the damping rate of this signal. How fast is this cosine decaying? 5 minutes left? Okay. And then they're looking at this as a function of field and temperature. Then they use some extremely fancy theory, which I'm not going to go into, but they basically looked at this linear field dependence. They said that this field dependence of the relaxation rate was, in fact, due to the fluctuations of these monopoles. Okay. Okay, so here's the data over a wide temperature range. The only data that was really used to extract anything about the monopoles was from down here. So the first thing that was wrong with their experiment is that they did a T2 measurement, and they extracted, because they're doing this in a precession geometry. Question? They've done that more recently. They also find monopoles. So here what they've done, okay, so they first of all, when they extracted their data, they said that 1 over T2 was proportional to the fluctuation rate. In fact, 1 over T2 is proportional to 1 over the fluctuation rate, so that's a problem. And the other problem is that T2 has lots of contributions to the broadening. T1 is one of them. These fluctuating fields will produce a T2, but so will an inhomogeneous magnetic field from, for example, a stray field. So this is our data. So we did measurements in a transverse field, and the red curve is at 200 Kelvin, the blue curve is at 2 Kelvin. What you see is at 200 Kelvin is that our precession signal, which should be going like this, is quite heavily damped, and that's because the holmium spin fluctuations, or dysprosium spin fluctuations, are in our time window, and they're giving us a T1 relaxation. As we cool down, however, we lose any sign that we even had an applied field. So there's a static internal magnetic field which is causing the polarization to decrease from here to here in our first nanosecond of the experiment. And there's a very large quasi-static internal magnetic field. So if you would do a precession experiment, there is no precession signal to see. This is shown at 2 Kelvin. There is no precessing signal in the sample. You can't measure a precessing signal because it's not there. This is measured in an apparatus which has no background. And so we did some measurements in longitudinal field, and you see again, you can see that we can extract the T1 from these measurements. Okay. So now what we said, well, let's take a look at, let's put our sample in the apparatus on a silver background, which is what they used, and let's post it also on a piece of gallium arsenide, which is covering the sample, which gives no precession signal. And if we look in the geometry they used, okay, where you have a forward-backward geometry, so the spins are starting off pointing in the direction of the counters, You get a blue curve. If you take the sample out, you get a red curve. So the red curve is purely muons landing somewhere far away in the tails of the cryostat. And in fact, when you do it in the better geometry, the left-right geometry, where you don't see the fast decay of the sample, you see that in fact the sample being there or not, it gives you no effect at all on the data. So we could write essentially the sample is not necessary to get the result. If you put the sample on silver, which is the way they did it, then you get data which looks like this, which looks almost exactly what they're measuring. So the precession signal was not from dysprosium titanate. It's actually from the sample holder. Okay. So we can now fit, if we take a look, if we do the experiment where we fit it, the data where it's on the sample holder, of course, this dysprosium titanate has a large ferromagnetic moment associated with it. If you land right beside something that's almost a ferromagnet, you will see a large field inhomogeneity, because it's going to distort the field lines of the field you're applying. And so we, in fact, see a temperature dependence of the signal, which is roughly what they saw. We have different backgrounds, et cetera, and a different fridge, so it's not exactly the same. So we think that the origin of this stray field is probably the sample magnetization. If we now do the experiment correctly again and look at do it in longitudinal field, where we really do measure the spin fluctuations, as we cool down from high temperature, we see an increase in the 1 over T1 relaxation rate. This increase as you cool down is due to, first of all, the depopulation of some of the other crystal field levels, plus a slowing down of the fluctuations. We got a familiar 1 over T1 maximum or T1 minimum. And as you cool down, the fluctuations are getting lower, smaller and slower, but still remaining finite down to this is sort of 1 inverse microsecond down to the lowest temperatures that we get to in a conventional cryostat. If we extend these measurements down to lower temperatures, so they continue along at exactly the same level. I'm now going from 4 Kelvin down to about 20 millikelvin. What we see is that we see a temperature-independent T1 down to the very lowest temperatures in these materials. So it's not of the activated form that we would expect for monopoles. Okay, and yet it's still quite large, and it's much larger than you'd expect if you think we have these, if the excitations are these single icing spin flips, the energy cost for flipping one of those is very large, and we wouldn't expect to have a temperature-independent relaxation rate down to low temperature. So we don't understand the origin of that right now. But there has to be some other spin relaxation process involved. So let me conclude now that the report of a monopole observation with transverse μSR, I think, is more than highly flawed. It's just wrong. The signal was in their sample holder, and then and t- to to compound that, they analyzed the data the wrong way. The actual result is that the T1 relaxation is independent at temperature, independent at low temperature. And to understand this, we're going to have to understand some additional dynamics beyond this spin-ice model. Perhaps we'll hear about that in the next talk. Thank you very much for your attention.
So thanks, Graham. So the paper is open for questions, comments. I'd ask you to wait for the microphone because it's being recorded.
I have a very straightforward question. Did you get in touch with this group, or did you find a consensus? Or
pardon me?
Did you get in touch with that group? So did you find a consensus in an analysis?
Well, we're just writing up our results. They have actually now started to think that maybe they sense monopoles by landing muons in a silver sample beside a sample containing monopoles. So they've changed their I think they're changing their story now. I think they understand now that they probably are we're landing in the sample. I don't think they understand the problem that they've analyzed their relaxation rate correctly. But I'm actually not quite so sure how to think about measuring the fluctuation. There's a problem. They think that they're still measuring a T1 process when they land in something beside their sample, and that has to be a T2 because it's just a field inhomogeneity. So this is the same group now that is now applying field pulses and measuring time dynamics and, you know, doing the Seamus's experiment. And I think that there's some issues with that experiment as well, that perhaps the time scales are not quite right. So we're working on coming to a consensus, but I think the consensus has to be that we're right and that they're wrong.
Well, putting that issue aside, so your observation is you have this T1 completely independent of temperature.
At low temperatures, yes.
At low temperatures, which itself is a kind of a mysterious observation.
Yes.
But does it depend on anything else? If you change the magnetic field in the environment, if you change the pressure?
Well, you can. It's we haven't done a detailed field dependence, but there is always a field dependence to a T1. And by looking at that, what we can if we can extract the field dependence of the T1, then we can directly measure the fluctuation rate. Because so far I haven't quoted a fluctuation rate of the fields. Because it's a product, essentially, of the fluctuation rate and the instantaneous moment size. So by looking at the field dependence, we can extract, assuming that it fits to the form that we normally expect for a single fluctuation rate, we can extract the instantaneous local field, which we can compare to calculations that Michelle has done for the local fields in the material. So in principle, we probably know what to wire in for the field, so we can extract the fluctuation rate directly of the moments. And just to see what it is, and we have that's sort of work that we'll be doing in the next week or two as we finish writing this up.
More than anything else, so would you come with a system that has a sort of a ice type extensive entropy,
mm-hmm.
and now you come with a magnetic field that essentially is like a transverse field, you begin to flip spins. So in principle, this could give rise to some kind of order state.
There are ordered states in these families of materials. You can apply fields certainly in certain directions, and you can go from a spin liquid state, and you can get into a state where you do have, you know, sometimes two of the moments frozen or three of them frozen, depending on that. The fields we're using are quite small, so the fields that are used normally to get the ordering to happen are sort of 500 Gauss, 1,000 Gauss. We're using tens of Gauss. So we're certainly in a weak perturbation limit, I think.
Your constant rate could be due to the fact that you have these bath of essentially degenerate fluctuations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something.
It's an extensive. You have an extensive degeneracy.
But in order to go from one state to another, there's a large energy barrier and you have to do simultaneous spin flips. So that seems it's not clear that should be giving us something on the time scale that we're seeing.
Further questions? Actually, just in relation to that, theoretically, I believe it's felt that the spin ice model, the dipolar spin ice model, should actually order, right, Michelle? Is that so? It's just, but the TC might be very low. Yeah, but there's a well. The other thing I was going to mention was that the other pyrochlore that maintains a flat T1 down to very low temperatures is
turbine titanate, yes.
And have you thought about whether there's any relevance to that?
The situation is, I don't think there's a very strong static component to the field here. I don't think that static component doesn't determine, you know, we don't get to that range, I don't think, we don't see this like big peak in 1 over T1 in terbium titanate. There it's sort of just, the relaxation rate just increases and plateaus. Here it's, you know, the relaxation rate is increased and come back down again. So we're on the slow fluctuation side of that. So there is there's a quasi-static internal field and we're looking at T1 relaxation of the tail, which is a different situation than we are in terbium titanate.
Okay. Any further questions? Well, if not, then thank you very much, Graham.